have the 20th of May 2016, and I am interviewing Adrian Coleman at the Knowledge Bank in Hastings. He was a lawyer and was born in Hastings. Could you tell us something about your childhood, Adrian?
Yes, I was brought up in a prosperous household, even though there were six children, because in those days farming was very prosperous. I remember going with my father to an auction in the municipal theatre in Napier, and his lamb's wool sold for £1 a pound, which means that it was $17 a kilogram in today's currency. Of course, a kilogram is just over £2. That would be $9 a pound, where at present it is only about a third of that, so that farmers have had to rely more and more on the value of the meat that they produce rather than the wool.
When was you born?
I was born in Hastings on the 11th of December 1940, and something that has always annoyed me is that when I went to a fortune teller to learn my future, she wouldn't do it because she said she needed not only the date but the precise hour of my arrival in the world. So my future remains a mystery to me.
So you were the oldest one or the youngest?
I was the eldest boy. We had a neat symmetry. Babies arrived in this order: girl, boy, boy, girl, girl, boy. I was the eldest boy.
So you grew up in a farm?
Yes.
How was it?
It was a lovely upbringing. We had all sorts of activities that we could do on the farm. We could go ealing. We could ride the horses. We could help our father go round the sheep, because in those days we went round the sheep on horseback, and coming home the horses would be frisky, knowing they were going home. So my father would give the signal and we would gallop back to the stable. He was pretending to gallop, but he would hold his horse back because it was much bigger than our ponies. But we felt we were having a race with him.
So your parents?
Yes. Well, now, of course, I know them well. My father was born in 1913, and I think it likely that it was a home birth, in which case he would have been born at Hillington, which was my grandmother's beautiful property in Koponga Road, which was on a large section given to her when she became a widow by Mr. Mason Chambers. He went to Whanganui Collegiate School. He went to Cambridge University in England, which is interesting because the sons of well-to-do families very often went to Cambridge. I think Cambridge might have been more receptive of young men from the colonies than Oxford. There he took his BA. He studied a little bit of law, so one of his party tricks was to quote sections of the Sale of Goods Act, which is possibly the best example of beautiful, lean, fine drafting on the statute book. My mother came from Christchurch, was born into a family that was thick with lawyers. She was brought up in an equivalently beautiful home called Gartmoor on Fendleton Road. It was a particularly lovely home because a small stream ran through it, and when she and my father married, they walked hand in hand down the long drive which debouched into Fendleton Road, and directly across the road was St. Barnabas Church, where they were married. Her father was a barrister. It was said that he refused a judgeship because he preferred his work as a barrister. He acted for the trade unions, which confused people because there he was, well off, living in the best suburb in Christchurch, acting for these troublesome people. His brother became a High Court judge, was the first president of the Court of Appeal when it was formed in 1957. His son became a judge, so it was no wonder that my mother wanted me to become a lawyer, if not a judge. I've disappointed her in that regard because I did not ever become a judge. who might be puzzled as to the difference between a lawyer and a judge. There's a marked difference. The status of a judge is very much higher than that of a lawyer. He's more of a peacock, while your solicitors are more like the hens in more subdued garb. In New Zealand, we have what's called a fused profession. You can be a solicitor and a barrister. In that regard, barristers spend most of their time in court. In England, solicitors can't have audience in the higher courts, so that there's a distinct separation between solicitors in England and barristers in England, which I disapprove of because I think it puts the cost up, rather like the dentist who now has a hygienist standing at his shoulder. So when you're in the dentist's chair, you feel that you're paying 1.5 times what you should.
How was the farm when you used to live with your parents? Where was it?
Well, it was 12 miles south of Waipukurau on the road to Prongahau. It was well chosen by my father when he got back from Cambridge because it had a good balance of flats and rolling hills. The flats were particularly useful for growing crops. And one of the nicest things I remember is seeing my brother, who had taken over the farm, getting trucks and harvesters in to harvest a crop of wheat. So these giant machines were trundling round the paddock and golden grain was pouring into the trucks, getting into lovely mounds. And I thought that was a reworking of the biblical references to the harvest.
Your mother was working in the farm as well?
No, my mother never went out the back gate. Mothers didn't in those days. Nowadays, of course, my brother Peter, who farms the farm, would have become insolvent if his wife hadn't rolled her sleeves up and got in, wrenched the lambs, crutched them, moved the stock. She became a vital part of the workforce. But because farming was profitable, there was no need for my mother to go out to help, and she confined herself to raising her 6 children. She would write to us weekly at boarding school, remember to put a paragraph at the end of the letter just relating to each one of us, and she arranged parties, tennis parties, costume parties. She also took Sunday school and helped in 1 or 2 community ventures.
She belonged to the Women's Institute or the Women's Division?
Yes. And she always felt peeved that Lady Ormond was the president, and Lady Ormond contrived to delegate the work required and not do any of it herself. So that was my mother's perception.
What about the school when you were a child?
Yes, well, in common with many farming families, the children were sent early to boarding school. And I went to Harroworth School, which is, you might have passed in Te Mata Road, from the age of 9. And I quite enjoyed boarding school, although we were always cold in winter. But in summer, if we had a good day, we got in 5 swims, which we enjoyed. I was in a special class and took Latin from the age of 9 and did well at Latin. Can still remember some of it. And one year, the headmaster was teaching us, and he became so exasperated at our failure to make our adjectives agree with our nouns that he went and got the cane and caned one boy, after which there was a great improvement. So I treasure that story. I also did French. We had a really good hobbies night on Tuesday nights, and my favourite hobby was the printing hobby, where we printed simple things like greetings cards, like titles of prayer books that had been wrenched apart, and our little presses would go round a little revolution each time you pulled the handle. The rollers carefully inked. You set your type by hand, which was a pleasant thing to do. You set it backwards. So the computer has robbed us of a lot of pleasurable things. The pottery hobby was another popular one that always looked a mess to me, with water lying about and misshapen pots.
And so when did you leave this school?
I had 4 years at Harroworth. I got to know top people, governors general, Court of Appeal judges, naval men, because I was always going up getting prizes at the prize giving at the end of the year. When I was on the Board of Trustees of Heroworth, I said that we should try always to get a person who would present himself or herself in full uniform, but my co-trustees didn't get the message.
And what did you study?
I suppose the curriculum was based on schools in England. I think we followed almost slavishly. So you'd have arithmetic, English, French, history, geography. In those days, your self-respect demanded that you have a map of North and South Korea, because the teacher would read from the newspaper at the beginning of the English class, and there was always news about the battle between North and South Korea. So it was a fight to get hold of the paper and cut that map out until everybody had one. We felt uneasy when the Labour Party newspaper was our turn to have it in our class, because none of us, we knew that our parents would have nothing to do with the Labour Party, and we felt that the teacher was trying to indoctrinate us with the wrong sort of information. So that was that. Then I went on to Whanganui Collegiate School on the other side of the island. The climate nowhere near as good as in Hawke's Bay, and I distinctly disliked football practice because we had to go down after school dressed in two jerseys for sure, pretty worn through washing and wear, and hang around for a quarter of an hour or 20 minutes until the master came down to begin the game. So I think it's a splendid thing that boys now have track suits and be kept warm while they're waiting. So that was one clothing item that wasn't so good. We also had cadets once a week, and we wore proper serge suits, sandpaper suits we called them, because they were very coarse. And once again, I enjoyed my time in cadets. I selected the section that was the least strict and rose to become the commander of the Air Training Corps. And I had my boots polished by my fag, of course. And so I've mentioned the word fag. That was a boy in his first year at school who was attached to a prefect, and he had to do simple tasks like cleaning the prefect's shoes or boots, collecting his mail, bringing him, I think you brought him his mug of cocoa in the winter term. One prefect impressed me by telling me that in the winter term he would send his fag out to the latrines to warm the lavatory seat after breakfast before he, the prefect, went to use the lavatory. I thought that was a wonderful thing. Winter as a new boy, the senior boys looked like giants, but gradually you realise that you're catching up and you find that the new boys are very small indeed. Discipline was strict. There was the cane for serious misdemeanours, and although it has its critics, the boys accepted it as a satisfactory form of punishment. If you break the rules, you get the cane, but after that, it's over. It doesn't accumulate in order to give you a more severe punishment at some time in the future. The house prefects, as well as the school prefects, were allowed to use the cane, but had to keep a record of it in the punishment book. So that was usually attended to in the prefect's room in what was called the big school, which was conveniently large, so the cane could be energetically swung. Every morning we had assembly in big school, and announcements were made, and the roll was checked. One of the important ceremonies was awarding caps to boys in the very top teams who had done well enough to receive a cap. And all those who already had caps would line up on the stage while the captain of sport would call up the lucky person, place the cap on his head. And of course, the little boys who were in the front of assembly were overawed by this procedure. And I well remember when a new headmaster came, Mr. Bruce Lockhart, we were assembled in big school, and there was absolute silence while we waited for him to come in. Could have heard a pin drop, and in he came, looked around. "You, go go to my study door because that person might have scratched his nose or something. Anyway, the sound of the cane was heard, and after that there was no problem in maintaining good discipline in the school. Oh, I'll just tell you that sport also, part of the ethos of a boarding school, the same at Christ College and at King's College, sport was compulsory, and my summer sport, which I really enjoyed, was rowing. And now that Whanganui Collegiate is an integrated school, the girls in particular are right at the top, representing New Zealand from my old school. So it's extraordinary how they've taken to that sport. Winter wasn't so good for me because although I was all right at football, I had to hang around feeling cold until the game started. Oh, and another thing was that lingering principles of holiness, I suppose, forbade us to play tennis on Sunday on the courts which could be seen from the road. I mean, that seems bizarre, but that was the case.
So after the college, you went to university?
Yes.
Where was it?
Naturally, I went to Christchurch because that was my mother's city. And for the first 2 years, I was in what we called a hostel, which you now call a hall of residence, single sex. Now I think they're mostly both sexes, on the assumption that girls will bring a better standard of conduct. When you see some of the girls, how they behave, according to the newspaper, they're worse than the boys at getting foolishly drunk.
It was not something usual in your time?
I suppose I drank a bit, yes. Yes, indeed. We had a hotel just across the river from a college house, just a short walk. So we would go there. I never much cared for draft beer, stale and no life to it, but that's what we were served because it was cheaper. And, of course, it was important that your girlfriend understood that she was to drink beer because we didn't want to pay for a fancy drink for her. College house was traditional, and you had to wear gowns for the evening meal, and it was a pretty rough collection of buildings. But it's now established at Ilam, where the current university is established. The move was made probably 30 or 40 years ago. In these gracious surroundings, the college house designed by Sir Miles Warren and his firm takes pride of place as the superior hall of residence. And they keep asking me for subscriptions, donations, because they say they've got to continue the rebuilding after the Christchurch earthquake. And what was life like as a student? Well, I worked hard at my studies. I envied others whom I met at parties who seemed more sophisticated and who never seemed to work, but it caught up with them at the end of the year. So they would return for yet another year, but make no further progress towards getting their degree. In the law faculty, we had perhaps 70 people at stage one, but when we graduated 4 or 5 years later, those were down to about a dozen, of which, say, 2 people were women. Now it's the other way around. Women just slightly exceed the men, and in the old stone halls of the university on its old site, we sat at tiered benches, and everything was dark brick and white stone. And one time, when I was in the French room of the library, word spread like wildfire that the Security Intelligence Service were in the building. So we closed our books and peered over the rail just in time to see a student fleeing out the barrier. And quick as a wink, the girl on duty locked the barrier so that the sleuth in his raincoat couldn't get out, and therefore whoever it was got away. We thought that was a triumph.
So finally you have your degree?
Yes. Yes, the graduation is a wonderful thing. It's a very nice day indeed, with your gown and your waterboard. The girls often had flowers walking down Cashel Street through the Arch of Remembrance. So that was a lovely thing to do. And of course the university was much smaller then. I think we were 4,000 at any one time. Now I think it's 11, 17. I read in the paper that Victoria University is now 21,000. Don't know what they all do.
And when did you come back to Hawke's Bay?
No, I took some time to return to Hawke's Bay. My first job was in Hamilton in the Crown Solicitor's Office. And then after a year, I came to Napier and worked in a Napier law firm. And then I came across to Hastings, where I've remained ever since. My work would be principally the buying and selling of houses, financing of orchards and farmland, dealing with estates of people who've died, a little bit of matrimonial work. I think it's interesting to mention that in my early days, divorces were hard to get, in that you had to do them in the High Court with all the associated costs. I remember three incidents to do with divorces, which the judges didn't much like. I think the judges felt it was inferior work, but they had to do it. Anyway, one of the grounds for getting divorce was adultery by your partner. There was a celebrated man in Napier called Edwin Elijah Carpenter, who would gather the necessary evidence. I was in court once where the lawyer was leading his evidence. Mr. Carpenter explained he'd set up the ladder on the downhill side of one of those wooden houses in Napier Terrace and just got up there and the lights in the bedroom were extinguished. Mr. Carpenter said, I'm sure I'll get the evidence. And his office pleaded to climb up with him, but the ladder broke, so they didn't get the evidence. So that was that. And then I had one with about a 47-year-old woman who was a pretty tough woman, and she wanted a divorce from her husband. But if she had committed adultery, she had to file what was called a discretion statement, admitting it and begging the judge to let her off. And so I handed up her discretion statement. The judge read it, and his eyes nearly bulged from his head. "What?" he said. "You're 47, and the co-respondent is 17. And then my finest hour was when I had the most beautiful woman as my client, and the other lawyers were sitting at their benches surreptitiously reading a magazine. But as soon as she passed them, they sat up, judge sat up, took his spectacles off, became really agreeable to my client. And the divorce went through like clockwork, so that people afterwards said, "Where did you find her?" And I modestly said, I can't say. So that was divorces in the early days. Now they do them routinely in the district court. We were talking about divorce, which the lawyers, like the judges, didn't particularly like, because if you made a mistake with your pleadings, with your papers, the judge would reject the application for divorce and you would have to wait for the next three-monthly sitting. So everybody was a bit tense. Also tense were the unfortunate female witnesses who had to wear a hat and gloves. When they went forward to stand in the witness box, the court crier suddenly put the Bible in front of them, said, "Place your right hand on the Bible." So there was a scramble to draw their gloves off, with everybody waiting until that was done.
And so what was about houses and lands?
Yes, I can remember things about that. The State Advances Corporation was the big lender for people starting at the bottom. And £2,400, which is $4,800, was sufficient finance for you to get into your house, plus capitalizing what was called the family benefit. So there's been terrible inflation of house prices since then, and the government did everything it could, both governments did everything they could to make it possible for couples to buy their own house. Older people do suggest that younger people want too much. They want the carpet on the floor straight away and a good washing machine. What else does a lawyer do? I used to do a bit of Maori land court work too, which was interesting. The Maoris have their own way of doing things. And on the day that the court sat, they would come in their throbbing old cars from all directions to have their day in court. You couldn't hurry them. Often it was succession orders were the most common thing. When a Maori person died holding probably six bits of land through most of Hawke's Bay, if she had six children, then those six plots of land, the children would be entered as 1/6 each of each. And what I'm trying to say is that you only need two generations till it becomes unmanageable. The government still hasn't solved the problem of fragmented ownership. A great deal of land remains unproductive. There was a propensity, which I detected, on the part of Maori men to marry twice, or if the wife died, to take another woman. So that instead of having six children, you had 12. So the question of the management of Maori land is just about impossible to solve.
And so you have been a witness of urban developing in Hastings and Hawke's Bay. You noticed huge difference between when you start and when you retire.
Well, it happens so gradually that you don't see it happening, but areas of pasture on the Hiratonga Plains around Hastings that were once where sheep grazed have usually got vines cultivated for crops like onions or squash. So you don't see many sheep when you drive from here to Wellington. On the hills in Havelock, there's been an explosion of expensive houses. When I was younger, it was considered that the land was unstable, could slip, therefore shouldn't be built on. But I suppose it has been possible to search for areas where there's no evidence of slip. Up behind Woodford House, you've got magnificent homes. Stretching out across the Arateke area, you've got nice homes. The Arateke area is on the north side of Te Mata Road. When I began, the Hawke's Bay County was ruthless in preserving land as rural land. And even though it was demonstrated to them that the orchards that were there were feeble producers, hardly worth it, they wouldn't yield. But finally, their chief town planning officer, whose word was law, retired, and sensible opening ups occurred. Remember that Mackesy Construction, very prestigious firm, geared up to build a new freezing works at Takapau, down south of Waipukurau. And although I wasn't involved, we took pride in the fact that Mackesy's could do such a big job. And now they have exceeded all expectations with a magnificent hotel being built in Havelock North. And I waste my time watching the cranes swinging around. And I said to my wife, we must be the first to stay at the hotel. But she wasn't impressed, so I tried again and said, why don't we be the first to dine in the new restaurant? But once again, she was disappointing.
You haven't talked so much about your wife and children.
Ah, yes. Well, Maureen is more shy than me. She grew up on a substantial farm in the Hakataramia Valley, which is in South Canterbury, but the Waitaki River runs nearby. And on the other side of the Waitaki River is Otago, with a little settlement called Kurau. So she finds it easier to say that she comes from Kurau. But now and again, if she's talking to a farming person, he says, I know the Hakataramia Valley. And it was a lovely place, downland, quite a substantial peak called Kirkliston, which of course we climbed, the little Haka River, which I fished in. We enjoyed those. What I haven't said is we went down with the children every second summer for a long time. One year we made quite a substantial balsa glider, and this was a huge success because the land sloped just about the level of the glider, so we could get long flights, 200 metres. We were pleased with that. She went to Rangiruru, which is Girls' Presbyterian School in Christchurch. Didn't much enjoy her schooling because her parents were often overseas. Then she became a nurse in the days when the nurses wore an elaborate uniform, sort of apron, skirt, and when the matron was a figure of awe. One of her contemporaries went round the old people's ward, which they had in those days, collecting their false teeth to wash them, and forgot to name them, so that when she came back, everybody had to try to fit them until they were... So that wasn't so good. The nurses were popular among the male law students because they needed to relax after what could be harrowing events like laying out a dead person. So they would get into the raspberry nips or the equivalent. Were very nice people to have. So that's where I met Maureen. And our wedding was held on the family farm in the Hackett-Harrimere Valley. There were 200 guests at least, I think. And because Presbyterianism still held sway, there was no alcohol. So my father arranged with the Curragh Hotel to have any of the guests who cared to come there after the wedding. And that was a very successful function. Then James arrived, our firstborn, and then Anna arrived. And then 6 years later, Henry arrived. And James done well by us because he's a tax barrister in Wellington. My father always pointed out the importance of a good address. So James's address is 1 The Terrace, Wellington, which is the same as the Reserve Bank. And he's astonished us. His wife, who was also a lawyer, she's a small, dark woman, and she would go into court, and the other lawyer, perhaps my age, which, look, she doesn't represent a threat, but then he would suddenly find he'd lost his case. But she turned her back on the law and she studied for the ministry. She's now a minister in the Anglican Church. James has got the bug as well. He studied for the ministry. He's now a minister, and together they're the joint vicars of the St. Mary's Anglican Church in Silverstream. So I enjoy it every time I go down. If we go to their 10 o'clock church on Sunday, then James and Julia, they're in immaculate robes, and their elder son is vocals and lead guitar. Their second son is on the keyboard. And you've got this pounding rhythm all generated. Well, there are others with instruments and other singers too, but these are the sort of the ones who stand out. So James does 4 days a week for his tax work, and for one day he helped Julia. So that's them. I'll just mention that Silverstream, much more benign climate than Wellington, and they're surrounded by bush, birds. They've got a lovely situation. Anna, the next child, is a teacher of speech and drama, and she's come down from Auckland to West Shore to live, and has a quaint little house that she's renting, which is ideal for, because her 11-year-old son is excessively energetic. But we've got Pandora Pool on one side where you can paddle and sail, the ocean on the other side, only 400 metres to his school. So that's been very nice, and we're enjoying having her close. And Henry lives and works in England. He married an English rose, and I think it's unlikely that they'll return. They have 2 daughters, 10 and 8, rosy-cheeked daughters. The elder has diabetes type 1, which has been a terrible trial. And they now have a dog called Willow, who's being trained to sniff the child's abdomen to see whether she needs more insulin. So that's interesting. And Henry worked for some time at Oxford University in the accounts department. And he was asked to examine the use of gas and electricity in the university to see where the savings could be made. So he made an appointment to see the vice-chancellor, which astonished the other 18 in the department, who were all Englishmen. And the chancellor was from Auckland University. I just can't remember his name. Anyway, in the eyes of the rest of the department, this was a surprising thing. So Henry went along, met the great man coming out of the lavatory, went into his study, sit down, Henry, what do you want to know? And got the information. And then when he was playing cricket for one of the university teams, the vice-chancellor came past. Hello, Henry! So all the others, what? So now he's a fully-fledged chartered accountant, and he's left that position, and he works for a firm somewhere nearby. There is a place nearby where the buses all go to get fake designer clothing, Billinghurst or something.
And did you buy your own family home?
Yes.
Where was it? Where did you used to live?
Oh, yes, in Havelock North. I always felt that my grandmother's home should have been kept for me, but it wasn't. And so the next best thing was buy one of my own. And we bought in 1968 a beautiful property, spacious, nearly 3,000 square metres, an old house that hired quite a bit of attention, but a lovely family home. And tennis court, of course, swimming pool, of course. I had the swimming pool put in. And a lovely grove of trees. Sadly, it's been massacred when we sold 10 years ago. A buyer who professed to be a tree lover cut down all the trees, put up a horrible mock Tudor house, and sort of ruined the proportions of the place. When I moved to Hawke's Bay and took up a position in the Crown Solicitor's office in Napier, there were three partners in that firm. When I moved to Hastings to join David Penn Scannell, there was just him as a sole practitioner with a great reputation among the community for a strange reason, that he didn't use a filing cabinet, and all round his quite large room are tottering piles of papers. But when the client came in to sign a document, Mr. Scannell would dart to a pile, shake it around, pull out the paper, to the amazement of the client. It was a very odd system indeed. I remember sitting across from his desk asking him to find a paper, and suddenly the sharp leg of my chair punched through the floorboard, making a little spiral of borer dust. This seemed to be consistent with the state of his premises, which were very old, and it wasn't too much earlier. There was a grass paddock out the back, and horses could be tethered and enticed to eat horseradish, which was planted there. Maybe that's 40 years before. Anyway, I was in partnership with Penn Scannell, Dennis Hardy, myself. Then, as the years went by, I formed a new partnership with Mr. Kennedy. Then, a new one with Mr. Porteous. Partnerships appear solid from the exterior, but they can be riven with feelings and discord, which has to be suppressed. And in the end, I practiced on my own account for the last 10 years of being in practice, just like my builder clients who would say to me, "Yep, I used to have several people working for me, now it's just myself."
Did you become a notary public at all?
I thought of that. I would like to have been, but the procedure was elaborate and the fee was something like $12,000. I felt I couldn't afford that. But notary publics did always intrigue me, because I think your grant was from the Lord Chancellor of England, or perhaps the Bishop of Canterbury, some special official. And one of the things they did, a place like Napier, was if a ship's master was required to sail into a storm, which he felt he shouldn't, not safe to do, and if the cargo moved or was damaged, as soon as he got to the receiving port, he had to go to a notary and make a protest, capital P. The other thing they did was, say you were acting for that woman who's lost her children to the Iraqi husband, if you wanted to prepare a sworn statement here, you would sign it before a Hastings lawyer, but then you'd have to go to a notary public for him to swear that he knows the lawyer who's sworn that he knows the client. So once something is notarially signed, notarially attested, then it's accepted all around the world as being a valid, truthful document.
When did you retire?
In December 2000.
Okay. Was you involved in an association during this period after your retirement?
Yes, well, I found it very frustrating because I had to learn to use the computer, which really made me angry. And so for a couple of years I was not all that happy, but I built a boat. That settled me down. I built a little boat from me to you, a bosomy little, and I used to wrestle with the problem of turning sheets of wood, which expect to be treated flat, making them curve. Everything about a boat is curved, but wood doesn't like to curve, so you have to fight to get the wood to do what you want. So that was something I enjoyed. What else did I do? I thought at first I wouldn't have enough to do, but as it turned out, I felt I had more than enough, because I had my music lessons, tennis lessons, helping in the gully near where we live. Yeah, and I couldn't see how I could have spent time at work the way my day seemed to slide away. So I think the chief thing is the feeling that deadlines are not important any longer. Not got to leave the house at 8:15. So I do waste a fair bit of time reading the newspaper, the Dominion Post. I want to mention one aspect of what I do. My wife, having told me that I needed to increase my voluntary service, and I realizing that I was unlikely to receive my knighthood unless I got into these projects. So I joined the Karataifinua Land Care Group. Karataifinua is a stream in a deep gully in Tumata Road, just beyond Durham Drive, just before you start to get out of the borough. Over about 20 years, a team of volunteers has changed it from a wilderness, a near impenetrable wilderness, to a very pleasant place to walk or take your dog, because I think the dog can run free. And I was down there this morning watering little native plants, and there's about 16 of us, which I think we're overstaffed. But anyway, we have to work only for an hour on a Friday morning, starting at 9, so that retirees can be got out of bed in time. And then we have a lavish morning tea after our hour's work. And when Dougal French was in charge, he would ask each of us what we had done that week or what was happening at home. I was always surprised by the detail. You know, my wife's goiter is playing up, which I felt was better left unsaid. And one day it got on to people's teeth, and just about everybody had some problem with their teeth, but it was too expensive to fix them. So a terrible dilemma. And the group is stuffed with ex-headmasters, and a class came through not so long ago, and I noticed Dougal French standing on the bridge addressing them just as a teacher would about the difference between a pot of carpers or something. And I've been hoping that these retired principals would get together to put an end to the Kura and substitute a new primary school for all, but they haven't. They've kept their thoughts to themselves.
So, Adrian, one other important thing that you did is writing a book about your grandfather.
Yes.
So, could we
talk about that?
Yes.
Yes. I enjoyed that. Towards the end of my time in practice, with my clients dying off or frequently leaving Hawke's Bay to go to live near a daughter, I did have time on my hands, so conceived this project. I had been given a deeds box, a metal box, very formal looking, J.H. Coleman Trusts is a difficult word. Trusts mean holding property for some other person. And there were some lovely things in there. There was court papers when Coleman Estate had to go to court. There were papers concerning the death of my uncle, who's an Air Force pilot in Britain, died in the Second World War. So there was plenty to start off with. But in addition, because I knew a fair bit about Maori land law, one of my Hastings friends would tell me gleefully, if ever the subject was raised, that the Ngāi-Tahu settlement, Ngāi-Tahu, a South Island tribe, the latest one is the fourth full and final settlement that has been made, because the Maoris don't seem to understand those words. They come back for another nibble. Anyway, since my great-grandfather was a well-known early pastoralist, farmer on a big scale, farming sheep, I was able to ascertain what land he had bought and how he had become extraordinarily wealthy. And he also had married a widow. A Mr. Farmer had suddenly died aged 47, leaving a widow and four small children under five. J.H. Coleman had married the widow a year later, and like a cuckoo had moved into Mr. Farmer's house on the Napier Hill. Beautiful big home. But I think that probably happened because the position of a widow in society at that time was unenviable, unlikely to be asked out socially and so on. So it gave her security, it gave him a leg up socially, and those four stepchildren turned out to be extraordinarily interesting. As to the eldest, Gertrude, she met and fell in love with a man called Grogan, who came out from England with her brother. Naturally, her brother had been sent to university in England, and Grogan asked the old man for her hand in marriage, and the old man huffed up and said, "Certainly not. You've been sent down from Oxford. You've been rejected. You've been expelled from Oxford. Go away and do something, then come back." So he did, and he made this terrific trip from Mozambique through to the Sudan. All the things we hear in today's newspapers about massacres and so on in Uganda and Rwanda were just described by him. Bodies floating in the streams and, you know, people ready to cut you to pieces. So there was a very good chapter on this exciting trip. Some of the guns you took were so heavy that a bearer had to carry them for you. And when you fired them, they were likely to knock you over. So the thing I most enjoyed was preparing a chart of the weapons that he carried to shoot the big game and the different muzzle velocities and things like that. So Grogan did eventually marry Gertrude, and they made their life in Kenya for the most part. Then another married a Baden Powell, which is a famous name. Another
Baden Powell scouting.
Yeah, Eddie. I said Farmer, I should have said Watt. It was Mr. Watt who died. Eddie Watt, one of these four little stepchildren, had an eye for property and made probably even more money than my great-grandfather, and was a famous racing man, particularly in Australia. So there was a lot of colour in the book.
So where did he settle?
Well, he started off working for the Reverend Samuel Williams at Tiati College, and they got on very well. And when he felt that he had found his feet, he moved to a cottage that he must have built near what's called the Riverbend Christian Youth Camp. But when Mrs. Watt became a widow, he married her, moved into this splendid house, a far cry from the one that he had left. When young men arrived from England, they were determined to succeed, to make over it, to be successful in their new land. And it was apparent that the best way was to become a sheep farmer on a big scale. So the early ones snapped up large quantities of land. There were Collins, Coleman, Farrison, Chambers. They went hard at it, and they had to buy it from the Maoris. Well, to start with, they just ran their sheep and didn't care about the Maoris' feelings. But then when order was established and the Maori Land Court was established, they were able to buy from the natives, which is what they called them in those days, and get a proper title guaranteed by the government. So some of the landholdings were very large. My great-grandfather, his was modest at 12,000 acres, which is about 5,000 hectares, but some of them were twice that, three times that. So you've got to get in first. And so it was a pushy society.
And about his land now, it has been sold?
Yes. What happened before Mr. Watt died, James had sold his property to Watt and Farmer, Watt and Farmer in partnership. And Farmer carried on after Watt's death. Then Watt's son, Eddie, came and took over the property, made plenty of money from it, I think by subdivision. Subdivision is usually the way that people build up their money in the bank. So one interesting thing is that when you drive south of Hastings, a long straight road, there is a statue to a famous racehorse who Eddie Watt owned. And the statue is back in the plantation of trees. You can't see it, but it's just a historical. We can find that in the book in a moment. He subdivided and sold all but 800 of the 12,000 acres of longlands. So he would have made a heap of money doing that. But I just want to find about the horse. He had a soft heart for horses as well as people. He erected a monument to commemorate the horse called Merriwee, who was destroyed on 9th June 1909 on account of incurable paralysis. The noble plinth still stands in a plantation near the Longlands Road roundabout.
So now we will talk more about your book.
Yes, I'll see if I can explain it coherently. James, my great-grandfather, was one of 15 children of a farmer and a miller in Norfolk. He must have decided that if the father's farm were cut up among 15 children, no one would make a living. So he set off for New Zealand. I think he had had a good education, because one of the items that we have is a framed page of paper on which his calligraphy is exhibited. And he won the prize in that year for the best calligraphy. He endured the long sail out from Britain on the Mataoka, stout three-masted vessel, took about 3 months. When he arrived in Wellington, he stayed on the vessel and went north to Auckland to look at land in Auckland, but he was not satisfied with what he saw. He came back to Hawke's Bay and walked, quite surprising, couldn't afford a horse, so he walked here and there about the province until he, by chance, accepted the recommendation that he go to see the Reverend Samuel Williams, who was in charge of Te Auti Station. Williams took him on, and that was a fruitful partnership which lasted several years. And between them, they developed Cattle Stud, which was the envy of the whole of New Zealand. When he felt that the time had come to make a move to farm on his own account, he purchased a block called Kaka'araka near Otani, and then he and his friend McCarty signed a contract to clear scrub bracken from a coastal property of 19,000 acres owned by the Nairn brothers. That must have brought in money for them, because he and McCarty ended up buying the station. Shortly after that, his health began to fail, so he sold his half share to McCarty, and the brand C&M on the wool bales still survives to this day on that coastal property. He then must have worked hard to acquire land closer to Hastings. It must be said that he employed one of the most vigorous storekeepers. In order to acquire land near Hastings, he negotiated with one of the storekeepers with a view to getting the consent of the native owners. The storekeepers have a very bad reputation now. They weren't small-time. Sutton had a large establishment at Ahuriri in Napier, and he was the most aggressive, and he did succeed in acquiring the interests of all the natives in the Te Awa O Te Atua block near Hastings. And James became the owner of that and acquired further properties each side. James then sold to Watt and Farmer, sold his, what he called his Longlands station, to Watt and Farmer. And it was then that Watt died completely unexpectedly, leaving a widow and 4 small children. The long and the short of it is that a year later, James married the widow. Mrs. Watt moved into the beautiful home on the Napier Hill that Mr. Watt had had constructed. He, Watt, was a very wealthy man in his own right, having made his money in the kauri log trade in Auckland. Having sold out of the Porouri property on the coast, owned by the Nairns originally, and having sold out of his Longland station, James was cashed up, and for the rest of his life he became what one might call a merchant banker, lending principally to other pastoralists. His wife saw to it that entertainment was provided on a grand scale. She was an accomplished pianist, and I treasure the fact that I have her piano now, and I see that in the early 1900s she must have played so much that it was tuned about every 6 months, whereas I can get by with having it tuned about every 6 years. So there were very smart parties held there, and then the culmination of their socializing, their entertainment, was when the eldest daughter was married. It brought Napier practically to a standstill. This was the wedding of Helen Watt. Now, the marriage of Helen Watt was particularly significant because she married into the Lowry family, another of Hawke's Bay's top drawer families. So that was a highly regarded marriage. The next daughter, Gertrude, is the extraordinary tale of meeting Grogan. Eddie Watt, the eldest child of the widow, Mrs. Watt, was up at Cambridge, and he, wanting to return for his sister Helen's wedding, invited his friend Grogan to come out to New Zealand with him. That is why Grogan appeared with Eddie at the Napier home called Waitatirau, and that is how he fell in love with Gertrude. But when he asked for her hand, the old man rejected him, said that he had wasted his time at university, he would have to go and make a man of himself. So he did, and he made an extraordinary journey from Beira, city on the coast of Mozambique, through Central Africa and down through the Nile. We can't really conceive of the dangers of that journey unless we read the chapter on Grogan, but he succeeded. He almost died several times of malaria and other diseases, but he returned to claim his bride, and they were married in London with the full ceremony. It's difficult to appreciate the money that the characters I'm talking about had. They had London homes, they had country homes. Wonderful. I really feel I've missed out there. Florence, the last of the daughters, married a Baden-Powell who was a brother of the Baden-Powell of the scouting movement. There's not too much about her. Then, if we leave those four stepchildren, we go on to James's death and the administration of his substantial estate, about $3 million in today's terms. And because his will had to deal with his own children and his stepchildren, it was a complicated will, and it led to trouble in the courts, which, of course, is a great waste of money. But it's fascinating reading the documents and seeing the names of the lawyers who were involved. So after the administration of the estate, we go to what I called the second generation, which are the children of James's son, Herbert. It was a devastating blow to James when Herbert was killed during the Second World War. And to mark the solemnity of that, James erected a chapel at Cranthorpe, west of Hastings. James's son, Herbert, had married and had produced four children, the eldest being my Aunt Helen, next being my father, James Herbert, next being my uncle, Peter Swinburne, and the youngest being Lloyd, who sadly was killed in the Second World War. He was a bomber pilot for the Royal Air Force.
So, Adrian, how did you manage to write this book? Did you collect archives? How did you collect this history, your family history?
I started with my material in the iron deeds box. Then I became interested in how the acquisition of land was done, which I could do by going down to the Māori Land Court records in Hastings, for instance. Then gradually it expanded, but it became necessary to bring it into order, had to be contracted again. Then I found that I could use papers past the archive of newspapers, but I was inexpert and didn't realize that I could make more precise James Henry Coleman. So I looked at countless Colemans, some of whom had gone to jail. And then, of course, with my father and his sister and his two brothers, there was adequate material for me because, you know, they were much closer in their generation. So that was that. Fortunately, I had a secretary who did the typing, which meant I didn't have to use the computer, so I slipped through